This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The first is the following. The Torah says, Kadoshim Tiyu, in the beginning of Parshas Kadoshim, the Torah says, Kadoshim Tiyu, you shall be holy, Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokechem, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. What does that mean, Kadoshim Tiyu? What does it mean you have to be holy? Says the Mechilta, Kadoshim Tiyu, Perushim Tiyu. You should be separate, you should separate yourselves, you should be Porush, you should be, what's a good word for Porush?
Distant.
Not quite distant. Sorry? Isolated, yeah, you isolate yourselves. Something like that. That, lichoira, on the surface, appears to be against our whole understanding of Yiddishkeit. That you must go into monasteries and isolate yourself, is that the idea of Kedusha? And in fact, that seems to be what worries Rashi at that particular place, because Rashi says, Purushim tiyu min ha'aroyos, u'min sha'ar aveiros. Because Purushim is difficult to understand. What does it mean? If it means you must be Purushim from the things you're allowed to do, that's not Jewish philosophy. If it means you must be Purushim from the things you're not allowed to do, of course you've got to be Purushim from the things you're not allowed to do. That's what the whole Torah is about. So what does the mitzvah of Kedoshim Tiyu add? What does it tell us that we didn't know otherwise? So says Rashi, it doesn't mean stam Purushim that you must isolate yourselves like the Christians do. It means Purushim Tiyu min ha'aroyus min sha'ar aveiros. You should isolate yourself from sexual forms of sexual immorality and from arayas, from sha'ar aveiros, from other aveiros. Because Rashi couldn't tolerate an understanding that Purushim Tiyu means literally you must isolate yourselves from everything. The Ramban says no ways. Purushim Tiyu means exactly that. You must be isolated even from the things that are mutarim, even from those things that you're allowed to have. You've got to isolate yourself. What does that mean? Now we're coming onto a strange philosophy. Says the Ramban, the Torah says you're allowed to drink wine. The Torah doesn't say how much wine you're allowed to drink. Does that mean you can get drunk? Who's at the telephone exchange there? So Purushim Tiyu means that you've got to, you're allowed to drink wine, but just a little bit. The Torah says you're allowed to engage in sexual relationships. And it restricts it to a certain degree. But to what degree? Kedoshim Tiyu. There's a certain amount of isolation required. The Torah says you're allowed to eat meat. How much meat? Once a day, once a week, twice a day? How much meat are you allowed to eat? Purushim Tiyu, just a little bit. Otherwise, says the Ramban, you'll find people who are Navalim Birushus HaTorah. They become despicable people with a Torah sanction. You can have a man sitting at your table filling his face with more and more and more and more in the most disgusting way. Where does it say in the Shulchan Aruch that you mustn't do it? Where does it say in the Torah that you mustn't eat in an unpleasant way? Where does it say in the Torah that you mustn't finish every last crumb on your plate and leave it spotlessly clean? Where does it say you mustn't do that? Purushim Tiyu. A little bit, you limit yourself a little bit. Says the Ramban, that's the meaning of Purushim Tiyu. And that becomes very difficult for two reasons. Firstly, in what way is this different now from standard Christian practice, Lahavdil? Purushim Tiyu, even that which the Torah allows you to have, you mustn't have. And this sounds like Chumrah business. That gives justification to all the people who find their religious fulfillment out of making things which used to be kosher, now trait, whether food or other actions. Where does that come from? What's the basis for such a thing? Secondly, how much is a little bit? We know how much wine you've got to have for Kiddush. It's got to be a revius in your cup and you've got to drink a rovkos. We know there's a measurement. We know how much matzah you've got to eat for the mitzvah of Pesach. There's a kazayis. It's clear. How much meat do you have to eat before you become a novel Birushus HaTorah? The Ramban doesn't help us. He just says, Kadoshim Tiyu means a little bit. But what's a little bit? Is a little bit a kazayis, a revis, a kebetzo, 10 kebetzos? How much? What's the shiur? It becomes very difficult to put into practice. So there are two questions on that Ramban. The first is, how do you put it into practice? And the second is, the whole philosophy seems strange to Torah. So this, our first question is the Jewish understanding of Kedusha. Taking the Ramban's line that it means perishus, it means minimizing even those things which we're allowed to do, what does that mean? Where does it fit into our philosophy? The second question is a question which disturbs every single person sitting here. And that's the following. How does one find the balance between being ma'urov im habriyus, being able to mix freely and smoothly with the man in the street on the one hand, and on the other hand being a frum Jew? How do you ensure that you're an uncompromisingly frum Jew, and on the other hand you can walk in the street and nobody's going to giggle behind your back? How do you find that level? Those are the two questions with which we deal tonight. And in order to deal with that, I want to go to a third concept which we've been discussing over the last 2 weeks. Not in this shiur, but in other shiur. And that is the concept of the relationship between form and content. Where we've discussed the importance of adhering to classical form, even if the content is not classical. And we've discussed the idea that to be unique is all very well, but to be unique out of form is no art. That doesn't need any seichel to be unique out of form. For example, I can bring you a stamp and I can say this stamp is worth 10,000 rand. Why is it worth 10,000 rand? Because it's unique. It has something that no other stamp in the world has. The letter A is printed upside down or something like that. So go and take any piece of paper and print the letter A upside down and make that a valuable piece of paper. No? At the same time, it has a certain form to it. It subscribes to the form of that particular issue of stamps, but it has something unique to it as well. That's what makes it worthwhile. So it is in all forms of art. The basic form of the art, the basic style of the art, has to conform strictly to classical requirements. As we said last night or this morning, you can't play, again, bang around on the piano and say this is unique music, nobody's ever heard it before. Sure, nobody's ever heard of it before, but it's not music. It's only music if what you're playing is old classical music. The same music that they played 10 years ago and 50 years ago and 100 years ago and 1,000 years ago. That same music you're playing. And if then you can say that I've played it like nobody's played it before, that's something. Then it's art. Then it's worthwhile. So one needs a combination of adherence to classical form, yet original content. Now this becomes very difficult because you might have understood that there's an inherent contradiction between classical form and uniqueness. For example, back to our ballet example. If I see all of the ballet dancers dancing precisely with absolute precision, every one of them with precise step, they look like one man. That's a very impressive sight to see. See a big corps de ballet, hundreds of people on the stage, all dancing with absolute precision. That's fantastic. But there's nothing unique about any of them. And if one of them starts dancing out of step, I'm not going to say, oh, you see, that's unique, that's fantastic. I'll say she doesn't know how to dance. And on the other hand, if everybody's dancing the same way, there's nobody who's dancing particularly specially. They're all mediocre in terms of that standard level. So how does one find the mean between excellence and conformity? Because where there's no conformity, there can't be excellence. Yet, where there's excellence, it would appear there can't be conformity. How does one solve this contradiction of maintaining faithfulness to classical style and yet ensuring that I don't become an automat? That I don't just do and go through the motions like everybody else goes. This is something I must tell you worries me very much with this Beis HaMidrash. Because one sees in various other places throughout the world that this has become a problem, and one has to try and find the key to solving the problem or to making sure that it doesn't become a problem here. Because all the people in this Beis HaMidrash come from different backgrounds and everything. So you put them all together, each one has a certain uniqueness. But as the Beis HaMidrash grows older and people get used to one another, and the thing grows and their children will grow up in the Beis HaMidrash, be born in the Beis HaMidrash, get married in the Beis HaMidrash, lachem me'avesim, die in the Beis HaMidrash, and their children will be living here, how does one ensure that there isn't such a conformity that it becomes stale? So you want to keep individuality. Each person should be his own idea and his own person with his own talents and his own way of doing things. And yet there has to be a certain conformity. We have halacha, we have particular minhagim, we have a particular approach to Yiddishkeit. It's not hefker here. It's not just any approach goes. There's a particular approach to Yiddishkeit. And we conform to that approach and we adhere to that approach. How does one ensure that adherence to that approach remains, but not at the expense of individuality? This is a major problem in human behavior. I'll go further and I'll say that preciousness is defined, or I'm going to define preciousness as an article which has both authenticity and originality. Now you might say that's very unusual. Sure, that's unusual, that's why the article is precious. What's a precious diamond? Take just a diamond that's cut like no other diamond's been cut before, because it's cut so badly it's not precious. But what you've got to do is you've got to take a diamond which conforms to all the specifications of diamonds, and yet there's no other diamond like this one. Then it becomes precious and special. You've got to take a stamp which conforms to the requirements of what a stamp is, yet there's no other stamp like this one. Then it becomes precious. That's the very essence of preciousness. That's what people value. And in people striving to become unique, they go crazy. Because there's such an urgent need to be unique, such an urgent need to be special, to be different to everybody else, to develop one's own ideas and one's own abilities, and yet to try and be within the framework of conformity at the same time. The method of achieving this in terms of people is through what we've been discussing over the last few days, and that is internalization. If you're going to take the Torah as an external imposition of certain modes of behavior, and you're going to simply adjust yourself to those modes of behavior, then you're putting yourself into a mass production mold. That's all. There's the mold. Boom, boom, boom. You're all the same. That's it. That's what you're doing inherently. That means you're taking an objective format, an objective press, and you're allowing yourself to be pressed with that press and finished with you, we can get on to the next one now. That's the guarantee to lack of originality and to lack of uniqueness. Where Torah becomes, or where one has to ensure that the Torah remains unique, is through internalization. The deeper you go into a human being, the more different he is. The Africans tell me that all whites to them look the same. And I tell them that all blacks to me look the same, and they can't understand it. They laugh. How can all blacks look the same? Whites all look the same. But that's how it is. If you look superficially, all people look the same. We're just used not to looking at each other superficially, because we try and understand a little bit about each other when we look at one another. But if you look at a person superficially, all people look the same. The deeper you go into a person, the more you find him unique, the more you find him special. If you look at just his face and the color of his hair, so you'll find lots of people with the same kind of face and color of hair. If you look at the color of the hair and the color of the eyes, fewer people. If you look at the color of the eyes and the shape of the nose, fewer people. And so you go down deeper and deeper until you penetrate into the essence of the human being, you'll find there's nobody like him. That's it. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't create any two people with the same inherent qualities, not even twins. Therefore, the deeper you allow the Torah to penetrate into you, the more it's going to touch chords that don't exist in other people, that can't exist, and therefore create a response that doesn't exist in anybody else. If you're going to respond to Torah superficially, you're going to respond the same way everybody else does. If you're going to allow Torah to sink deep in and to pull chords right inside your heart, then you're going to notice that your response to Torah is different to anybody else, because it's touching chords inside you that nobody else has. Furthermore, the more you penetrate into the Torah, the deeper you'll find it is, and the more you'll be able to find uniqueness, the more you'll be able to internalize it. It's very difficult to internalize something superficial, because internalization means teaching it to the neshama. You can teach some Torah to the brain, and you can teach some Torah to the neshama. If you want to teach Torah to the neshama, it's got to be deep stuff, because the neshama doesn't tolerate superficiality. So what we're talking about here is making sure that one's learning and understanding of the Torah is sufficiently deep to appeal to the neshama, so that the neshama can absorb it in its deepest form possible. And then one will find that one's understanding is unique, that one notices things in the Torah which nobody noticed before, that one puts it together in a unique way, and that most important of all, one responds in a unique way. But then comes the danger. Now you make your own religion. That's also very easy. So you start making your own ideas, and you see the Torah in this way and that way, and you formulate it into your own opinions, and you make it into your own responses, and you come out with something which is no longer authentic. That's the key to it. One has to internalize and then bring it back out again, and what you bring out must still be genuine. That's what it is. Not like a printing press where each one is identical, but rather like some kind of machine which takes in the raw materials and puts out something which is within certain specifications, although each one might be slightly different. It's within certain broad specifications. So what we want is that the Torah is swallowed and is digested and is understood in all its depth, and it touches chords which it doesn't touch in anybody else, and then one is able to bring it back out to expression, and it conforms to the specification of Torah. It remains authentic. A person can listen to a shir and he can repeat the shir meticulously, word for word. It's not going to excite anybody or stimulate anybody. It will be accurate, but it's not his. It hasn't been internalized. Rabbi Elia Lokin used to say to his Talmidim, he used to say, I don't mind if you repeat what I say. I don't even mind if you don't mention my name when you repeat what I say. I don't even mind if you repeat what I say in your own names. I don't even mind that. But do me a favor. When you do it, don't make such a mess of it that I can never use it again. And he used to say, and how do you ensure that you don't do that? Very simply, he says, when you've listened to a shir, it's got to have gone right through all your intestines and all your pipes in such a way that when it comes out it's yours, not mine. Then I don't mind you saying it. Then I've simply given you the raw material which you've absorbed, and now it comes out as yours. But it still is authentic. It's still the real thing. But its form is unique, its form is changed, and it's different. So one has to internalize the Torah, otherwise the Torah has no effect on one. If one listens to a shir, it's like we were talking in the Gemara shir on Thursday, the difference between external knowledge and internal knowledge. Just to hear it and understand it and then leave it, that there's no internalization at all. It doesn't affect you, it doesn't change you. You don't become bigger, you don't become better, you don't become anything. The important thing is the internalization. The internalization occurs basically through deep understanding, analysis, taking what you've heard and pulling it to pieces and putting it back together again. Because when you've done that, it won't be the same. When you've taken something sophisticated to pieces and put it together again, it's slightly different to the way it was before. If you take a brand new motor car that runs perfectly and take it into any garage and ask them to repair something, you can be quite sure when it comes it won't be like it was before. Because even when they put it back together again, it's not the same as it came out of the manufacturers, that you can be sure. And it's the same here. When you take a shira, you take a concept in Torah and you analyze it and you put it to pieces and you understand and you question it with brutal honesty. Don't take anything as just said, but make an effort to understand every principle, every idea and every thought. And when you put it together again, it's yours. It's internalized. You've worked it. You've made it part of you. You've had a sleepless night over it. You've sweated over it. Then it becomes yours. And I must tell you that applies to this shiur perhaps even more than to any other shiurim, just by the way, while we're on the subject. Because this shiur is the kind of thing that if you don't internalize, it's more or less useless information. The hour might be entertaining or not, depending on the standard and quality of the shiur. But any knowledge thereafter is virtually wasted. Unless it's internalized. And internalized means revision. And I've told you, it means revision, going over the psukim that it's based on, going over the mefoshim that it's based on, going over the gemoras it's based on, analyzing it, reconstructing it, and so on. Those people who've done that over the years have acquired my hashkofa. It's not my hashkofa, it's the hashkofa which comes from my Rebbe, which comes from his Rebbe, which comes from his Rebbe, which comes from his Rebbe, who happened to be Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So it's a worthwhile thing to acquire. Those people who've done it have acquired it to the extent that I can trust them to say something over in my name, and I know even if they say something that I never said before, the idea is correct. And there's some people that have been sitting here for years and they have no idea. They might know the shiurim, they can repeat what I've said, but in terms of acquiring an approach to life based on the shiurim, nothing at all. And it's just a bit of a waste of time. It's worth the extra effort. to actually acquire a method. And this is what is required, that at the end of it, there is both originality, that the way you understand it is unique, but nevertheless authentic. It has to be accurate within certain forms, and it also has to be unique. It also has to be your own. Otherwise, you can't get excited about it. If it's mine, you can't get excited. It's got to be yours to be excited. You've got to pull it to pieces and put it together again. We've discussed before that the word the Torah uses for internal knowledge is shemia, to hear something. Because when you see something, although one sees with accuracy, firstly one sees with emotional coldness. One doesn't see with any real kind of involvement. It's hearing which gives the involvement. That's the difference between seeing a play and listening or watching an opera. The music draws one in so emotionally that the whole thing isn't very clever, but it's emotionally very intense. Whereas a play might be clever, but it leaves one emotionally cold. So the word the Torah uses is shmir. Furthermore, just on a physical level, seeing doesn't enter your body at all. Sight is just the impression that light waves make on your eye. It's not something that comes in. Whereas a sound wave actually goes inside your head. There's something physical, a physical movement, which actually penetrates. There's a hole on the side of your head through which these things are pushed. So there's conceptually, the concept of shmir represents far more internalization than the concept of re'iyah. Just before Matan Torah, we're told, B'chodesh HaShlishi, the beginning of chapter 19, in the third month when the Am Yisrael left Mitzrayim, on that day they came to Midbar Sinai. And they went from Rephidim and they came to Midbar Sinai, and they camped at the Midbar, and Yisrael camped there at the mountain. And Moshe went up to the mountain to tell the Ribbono Shel'olam, obviously, that Am Yisrael had arrived and they were ready. Vayikra elav Hashem min ahar lemor. And the Ribbono Shel'olam calls to Moshe from the mountain, saying, Ko soma leves Yaakov vataged livnei Yisrael. Explain the following to Beis Yaakov and tell it to the Bnei Yisrael. What we're going to have here is the basic condition for Kabbalah HaTorah. That's what they need to know before they can even be mekabel the Torah. Some of the Mefarshim give the example that if a man wants to marry a wife and expect certain things from him that she might not be aware of, and vice versa, it's only fair that they clarify these things before they get married. No point in getting married and standing under the chuppah and thereafter saying, now I expect you to do A, B, C, D. One expects one's wife or vice versa to do anything out of the ordinary or anything which is not included in the ksuba. And most chassonim and their wives don't even know what's written in the ksuba. If it's anything which is not included in the ksuba, they must specify it. And they must say, look, this is the condition. This is the kind of life we're going to be living. And this is the kind of thing I expect from you. Can you make it or can't you? That's it. If not, we must break it up. So here, say the Mefarshim, before the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, married Am Yisrael, he felt it fair to tell them basically what was required of them. So what we're going to see now is the essence of Torah. The basics of that which is going to be required on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam from Am Yisrael. Atem re'isim asher asisi le'mitzrayim. You saw what I did to Egypt. Va'esu eschem kanfei neshorim. And I carried you on the wings of eagles. Va'ave eschem eloi. And I brought you to me. Okay. Ve'atoa. Now. Im shamaya tishmu ve'koili u'shamartem es brisi. The condition is, if you will shamaya tishmu bekoili, listen carefully to my call, to my voice. The voice is the pnimius. The voice is what comes right from inside a human being. The Chazal tell us that no two human voices are the same. A voice is unique. And to identify a voice, you need shmir. You've got to listen carefully to the call, to the pnimius of what I'm saying. Not just to the surface of what I'm saying, to the pnimius. An example that is sometimes given of that is if you work in association of ideas with people and you say, tell me the first thing that comes into your mind. And you'll say pen, they'll say pencil, you'll say chair, they'll say table, you'll say lunch, they'll say supper. You'll say headache, and they'll say aspirin. That's one kind of person. Another kind of person, headache, tension. This is a deep psychological test because the second person is an intellectual. The first person is a superficial person. Headache, what do you do for a headache? You take a pill. The other one thinks the other way around. Headache, what's the basic cause of a headache? What's the problem manifested by a headache? Tension, it's a concept. Headache is simply a symptom of something much deeper. And so his association of ideas will lead you, or will lead him to understand the real concept. That's how an intellectual thinks. When he says pen, he doesn't necessarily say paper, and chair, he doesn't necessarily say table. What's the connection between chair and table? That's superficial thinking, to say table when you say chair. And to say aspirin when you say headache is also superficial thinking. When you're talking about shemia bakol, to listen to the essence, to understand the principles, that's what we're talking about here. V'hato, im shamaya tishmu bakoli, if you will listen to the principles and you'll internalize them. Ushamaltem es brisi, but at the same time there's got to be shmiras bris. When you come and do what you've heard, it's got to look like that covenant I've made with you. I've made a deal. You've got to act in a certain way. And after that internalization, you must be able to express yourselves within the confines of my bris. So it's the two opposites. It's got to be internalized, unique, the way nobody else has done it before. And yet it's also got to be brisi. It's also got to be my bris. You can stand and... Before that, I'll tell you a story with the Vilna Gaon. There was a city nearby, a village nearby, where a court case was going on. And the Dayanim wrote to the Vilna Gaon and said, we don't know what to do. We have a man here who's accused of a certain wrong. We cannot believe that he did it. We know the man, and there's no way that he could have done that wrong. On the other hand, we've cross-examined the witnesses for weeks, and we cannot find one thing in which they disagree. We've subjected them to the most severe cross-examination, but we still feel there's something wrong and we don't know what to do. That's a problem. That means they fulfilled the formalistic requirements of cross-examination, and if they follow the formalistic dinim, they're going to accuse the man of having done something which they're sure he didn't do. And the din is that Dayanim have to use their own seichel as well. They don't just go by the book. They've got to use their own judgments all the time. So the Vilna Gaon said, you found the words of the Edim 100% accurate? They said 100% accurate. He said, in no slight detail could you find any minor fact in which the two Edim disagreed? They wrote back, no detail at all. We've gone down to the most detailed detail possible, and in no matter could we find that the two Edim, that the two witnesses, didn't correspond 100% accurately. So the Vilna Gaon wrote back and said, in that case they're false witnesses. It was a shock, and they came to see him very quickly, and they said, where do you get that from? And he quoted them the Mishnah in the third parak of Sanhedrin, where the Mishnah says, im nimtzu divreihem mechuvonim, after cross-examining the witnesses, if their evidence is found pointing in the same direction, then you accept it. Says the Vilna Gaon, it doesn't say if their evidence is perfect. It says if they're pointing in the same direction. Because you cannot have perfect imitation and genuineness. If a thing is genuine, it's unique. If a thing is unique, it can't be imitated. And if two witnesses can imitate one another perfectly, then there's no way that you can have genuineness. It's again a little bit like the Gemara we learnt on Thursday night, where what we want to see on these witnesses is the human impression it's made on them. Not their absolutely objective, accurate report of what happened. Because you can't catch them out. If they're just telling you facts, then of course they'll both tell you the same facts. The only way you'll catch them out is by appealing to their uniqueness, to their humanity. Let's see what impression it made on them, not let's see how they saw it. Because of course the two people saw it the same way, but they weren't impressed the same way. And by the way it impressed them, we'll be able to know what really happened. So the Vilna Gaon said, if you can't find any different impressions, then neither of them were impressed at all, and they made the whole thing up. So here we've got Shamaya tishmu bekoili ushamaltem es brisi. If you look from the distance, imagine you walk into a shul with 1,000 people davening Shmona Esrei, and you don't know anything about Yiddishkeit or Shmona Esrei or anything. You'll see 1,000 people all doing the same thing, all standing facing the same way, shaking almost the same way, bowing like this almost at the same time, and virtually at the same time taking 3 steps back, and that's it. And on the one hand there's tremendous beauty to that synchronization. And on the other hand, you'll feel, what's it, a show, no uniqueness, no self-expression. But if you're able to look into their hearts, if you're able to see the way the words they're saying are impressing them, And you'll find each person is different. One person says, Chameinu me'itcho deo bino v'haske. Ribbono shel Olam, Shalom, give me knowledge. So one person's thinking, I've got an exam tomorrow. Another person's thinking, I've got a business deal tomorrow. Another person's thinking, I've got a tosfos I don't understand. Another person feels, I'm just inadequate to handle life, I need more knowledge. Each one responds differently to what the bracha says. You come to another bracha, v'lamal shini malti itikva v'chol harisha karega toived, may all the wickedness be wiped out from the earth. One person will be thinking of his mother-in-law, and one person will be thinking of the Arabs, and one person will be thinking of the Germans, and one person will be thinking, who knows, what impressions, what's going on in the mind of each human being. Unfortunately, what happens all too often, and that's what we talked about this morning in Shul, is that even impression-wise, it's the same with everybody, because nobody's being impressed at all. Okay, then even if you penetrate into the heart, you're going to find it all the same. But the important thing is to understand that while in form, when you look at it from the distance, everything is complying to perfect form, classical style. If you open up the heart, each one is different. Each one is deep. Each one is a world on its own. And there's no... And then, immediately afterwards, says God to Moshe, V'yeyisem li segula mikol ha'amin. Then you will be a segula from all the people. What does a segula, says Rashi? You won't believe what Rashi says. Otzar chaviv, a precious treasure. That's a segula. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants from us. He wants the quality of preciousness. Have you ever heard before the Musar people considering preciousness as a midah? But it's a new midah we've just discovered. There's a midah of chesed, and there's a midah of anova, and there's a midah of gaiva, and there's a midah of all sorts of things. There's also a midah of segula. You've got to be precious. And being precious means authentic and unique at the same time. That's what being precious means. And human beings have a craving for preciousness, and unfortunately we tend to confuse a craving for preciousness with materialism. But it's not materialism. For example, you can have a person, take our old example, who has a stamp worth 200 rand. And he treats it with incredible care. And he takes it out and he shows it to you. The stamp is unique. And if you look at that and look at the color, and it's not quite the same as the others, but basically it was printed at the same time and the same press as the others. And nobody knows how it came out like that, but it did. It's unique. It's special. And it's worth 200 rand. It's fantastic. And he puts it away back in his safe. And you look at his dining room suite. And it's a very ordinary dining room suite, but it's worth 1,000 rand. And that he lets his children climb over and walk over, and he doesn't care. So it's not money he's after. It's not materialism he's after, because if it was money, he should leave his stamp on the floor and put the dining room suite in the safe. It's preciousness that he's after. He values the fact that this little piece of paper can be so valuable. Why? Because it's unique, and yet it conforms to a certain style at the same time. That's precious. That's unique. If you go into anybody's safe, just imagine for yourself for a moment. Go and open people's safes. What do you find inside? Things that are not necessarily so valuable in terms of how much money they're worth. You'll usually find that there's more value outside the safe than inside the safe. And that's why burglars don't go for the safe always. They want money. They don't want preciousness. And for money, you can find other things lying around in the house. You'll go into the safe, you'll find personal things. Things that are meaningful to the person. Documents. Things that he wrote. Letters. Things that are, they conform to a certain style, they have a certain place, and they're unique, they can never be repeated. Let's move on now. So here we see there's a requirement on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam for Am Yisrael. In fact, it's not just a requirement. This is the precondition for Kabbalas HaTorah. You've got to accept upon yourself to become precious. That means to conform to classical style, but be different to any other person you've ever seen or you ever know of. That's required before we come to Kabbalah Satorah. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam at this point realizes the danger. If you let them express their religion freely, they'll all become hippies. If you make them conform, they'll all become boring and conformists. So there's a point in giving them so strict and formal a Torah, only if they're prepared to understand that that formality is their starting point. They've got to internalize it and produce their own formality, which adheres, that is unique at the same time. Kedusha. What is Kedusha? So we have this problem. Reb Shimon Shkop, in his Hakdama, in his introduction to Sha'arei Yosher, asks another question on the Ramban. Our first question on the Ramban is, what's the shear? What's the measurement of a little wine, a little meat, a little sex? What's the measurement? How much? The Ramban asks a further question. The continuation of the Pasuk is, Ki Kadosh Ani, because I, the Ribbono Shel Olam, am holy. How can you use that same definition for God? That God has to only take a little bit of what's permitted to him. Everything's mutter to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Nothing's mutter to the Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't apply. That definition doesn't work when you apply it to God. And yet the Torah in the same Pasuk talks about Kedusha with respect to human beings and the same Kedusha with respect to God. And therefore says Reb Shimon Shkop the following yesod. He says, and listen to this carefully, the essence of Kedusha is that everything you do should be letovat haklal, should be for the good of the community. Everything you do. Kedusha. How does he get that? Very simple. Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon says, what was the reason that God created the world? What's the purpose of the world? So Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon says, since God is the essence of goodness, part of being good is to give goodness to others. So he created a world to which he could be good. So why does he give punishments and so on? We won't go into that at the moment. We've discussed it previously and we'll discuss it again one day. But that's the basic relationship between God and the world. He is the mative and we are the mekablim. We are the recipients of his goodness. The whole world is the recipient of his goodness. And he says, Kadoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani. You must be holy because I am holy. What is God's holiness? The way he just gives to the world. Everything he does is give, give, give. He doesn't take anything from the world at all. So says Reb Shimon Shkop, the essence of Kedusha for us is to make sure that everything we do is giving to the world, not taking. It's an incredible concept of Kedusha, but that's what he says. And therefore he says, what's the meaning of the Ramban? Perushim tiyu, that you must isolate yourself. Says Reb Shimon Shkop, that means you must isolate yourself from any action or pleasure which is not for the good of the community, which is not for the good of everybody. That you're not allowed to have. And that answers all the questions on the Ramban. What's the shear? What's the measurement? It's up to you. The measurement is you can have as much of Olam Hazeh as you want. You can have as much of this world and all its materialism as you want, provided you need it for doing good to others. It's like my old example where I used to tell you that if I go overseas on behalf of my company, they look after me very well. Whatever I want, comfort that I don't even have at home. Provided it's all for the business. If I want to take a week's holiday in the middle and go and have a good time, that's also okay, but that I've got to pay for. If we're busy acting on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam in this world, he'll see that we've got whatever we need. But if we're busy here on our own account, if we've come here for a holiday, then we must do our own work. We must find what we need ourselves. And that, in fact, is a Ramban. The Rambam says in the 9th Perek of Hilchus Tshuva, he discusses where the reward for mitzvahs is. Is it in the world to come or is it in this world? And he says the following, listen carefully. Elokachu echrei akol advarim. This is the whole story. HaKadosh Baruch Hu nosol lanu Torah zu etz chayim hi. God gave us this Torah, which is a tree of life. V'chol ha'oise kol ha'kosuv ba, v'yoido deo gemura nechoyno. And everybody, no small order, but still, everybody who does everything that's written in it and knows it completely, right, and correctly. It's not good enough to know the Torah completely. You've got to know it correctly as well. And rather know a little bit less of it correctly than know it all wrong. You need Deo Gemura Nechoina. It's got to be a complete knowledge and a correct knowledge. Zoyche bo lechaya ho'ilam haba. He will have ho'ilam haba. So it looks as if we're in for a tough time after we die, unless we work quickly. And according to how much he knows and how much he's done, that will determine how much Olam Habo he gets. If we keep the Torah out of joy, right? Not a heavy burden, Yiddishkeit. I've heard people say in Johannesburg, the Torah is, when somebody complains and says, how are you, oy, things aren't so good. But don't worry, it's Torah, that's how it's got to be. Chas v'sholem. Not at all. Besimcha, if you carry out the Torah besimcha, with love and joy, uvatovas nefesh, and with good spirit, v'nehneh bechochmas atomid, and you enjoy the chochma of Torah, When you hear a good shir or you see a clever tosfos, you enjoy it, it's pleasurable, it's lovely. The people who think that you mustn't enjoy learning. It's got to be hard and miserable and just know it, that's all there is to it. Nothing to enjoy. You've got to enjoy the chokhmah, tamid, always. Shiyasu mimenu kol advarim hamoini meisonu milasoiso. Then the Ribbono Shel Olam will remove all those things which disturb us in our learning. Could go in choli, illness, milchama, war, rav, poverty, uchigetze, bohem, and so on. V'yashpia lanu kol ha-toivos ha-machzikus es yodeinu la'asos ha-toira. And he'll give us everything we need to fulfill the Torah. Could go in soiva, plenty, shalom, peace, v'ribui kesef v'zohov, and plenty of silver and gold at today's values. Can you imagine what that is? And you've got people going around saying, "No, gashmias, you sit and learn, that's all. You mustn't go off the gut." It depends. You can't define gashmias, materialism, as bad and spirituality as good. What's important is how much you need. Are you using your gashmias for others? Are you using your gashmias for Torah? Then the Ribbono Shel Olam will give you whatever you need. If you want it for yourself, then do your own work. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want us to live all our days busy just with things that our body needs. So the Ribbono Shel Olam will see to it, if we're doing correctly, that we have enough to put away, that we can retire at some stage, that every day we can learn a little bit, that one might be able to retire earlier than one thought, that one can take Shabbos and Yom Tov without any problem, that one can take a few weeks before Pesach off to learn the dinim of Pesach, that one can take the month of Elul off to do tshuva. The Ribbono Shel Olam helps us. To enable us to sit vacantly, to learn wisdom and to do the mitzvahs. Of course, if when we have the vacant opportunity we spend it talking nonsense, then the Ribbono Shel Olam sees that it's not for him. That if every free moment we've got we use constructively, as Rav Shimon Shkop defines, for others, for the world, we're busy putting into the world in one form or another, then the Ribbono Shel Olam will see that we have whatever we need. And so he goes on, this is a long piece of Rambam which we'll learn soon. Says Rav Shimon, if a man is basically doing good for the world, let's say whatever it is, he gives 10% of his income to tzedakah, then obviously it's in the interest of the Ribbono Shel Olam to increase his income, because the more he gets, the more he'll give. Furthermore, if a man, for example, teaches, let's say even he teaches once a week, but it's a very important shiur that he gives, and that's all he can, we're talking obviously where that's the maximum he can do, he's incapable of doing any more, he does the most he can do, then everything he does during the week is also considered for others. The fact that he keeps himself alive, the fact that he eats, that he drinks, that he works, whatever he does to make himself able to perform that one mitzvah, that one action which he does every week to give his shiur, that the Ribbono Shel Olam considers as doing for others. In other words, you've got to see that everything you're doing is directly or indirectly projected towards doing for others. That your main function, your main purpose is to do for others. Then everything you do for yourself is automatically for others. Provided it's not meitaros, provided it's not excesses. So to eat a chewing gum, is not nobody else benefits out of that. To sit down and have a meal, that's fine. Then you can say, I'm having a meal so that I should be healthy. And even more than healthy, that I should feel in a good mood so that at the end of the meal I can open my Gemara and I can learn the simcha of a tov lev and I can prepare for my chavrusa. That's fine to eat a good meal, so you can eat a three-course meal, a four-course meal, you can have coffee and liqueur at the end of it. If that's going to help you get into the right mood to do your maaseh tzedakah, to do your action of kindness, immediately the meal's over. But not chewing gum. There's no place for chewing gum in halacha. What does anybody else benefit by the fact that you munch on something and then spit it out? And so not to do any of the other things that are unhealthy. Then says Rav Shimon Shkop, that's the essence of Kedusha. That everything you're doing is for others. You must realize, to see the lighter and the more pleasant side of all this, what a schus this is. Because take a man who doesn't do much, yeah, he does what he can, his little bits, he davens every day and he keeps Shabbos. No great checks. But everything he does is geared towards supporting his family. He battles for a living. He does his exercises. He eats. Everything he does is geared just so that he should have enough income to support his family. That man is a kodesh. That man is involved in holiness, according to the definition of Rav Shimon Shkop. because everything he's doing is for others. There are different degrees of holiness. He's just worried about his family, whereas a Godel B'Yisrael might be worried about the whole world. They're different. There's a scale in between. But at least such a man is constantly involved with others. And a man who's in professions, a man who's a doctor, a lawyer, a businessman, constantly involved in doing something for other people. You'll say, but he's doing it for himself. We all work for the money. He's not doing it for other people. True. But you remember we learned that the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, if a person gives tzedakah al manas sheyichye bni, person says, here's 100 rand for tzedakah. I'm giving it to tzedakah on condition my son recovers from his illness. So is he giving tzedakah for other people or is he giving tzedakah for himself? It's for himself. Yet the Gemara says, harei ze tzadik gomer. That's a perfect tzadik. There's nothing wrong with that at all. So it doesn't matter if you're doing something for yourself as long as the action is for others. As long as other people are benefiting from what you're doing, it doesn't matter what your motivation is. Sure, if your motivation is holy, it adds to the quality of the action. But tzadik gomer, you consider a tzadik gomer by doing something for others, even though it's for your benefit. So a man sitting in business working out how he can make a better washing machine than his competitors, that should save the woman 2 minutes more when she's doing her washing, what the woman's going to do with those 2 minutes extra is not his business, but still, it's chesed. He's occupied in doing something for other people. You have a man who establishes a supermarket chain to work out to bring down the price for the housewife. The thing should cost her at the end of the month, her grocery budget should be a little bit less. The man's involved in kedusha, kula yom kula. He sits and he plans and he schemes and he negotiates and he lies in bed at night and he works out how can he get this cheaper and how can he reduce costs still more. He's constantly involved with doing something for other people. Sure, for his own pocket. Sure, he wants the benefits. Tzedakah menashe yichye bini. I'm doing it for others, but on condition there's a profit in it for me. No profit for me, I don't do it. Okay. But still there's a concept of tzadik gomer. There's a concept of a man whose whole thought process is involved in doing things for others. That, according to the definition of Reb Shimon, falls into the broad category of kedusha. What is important, by the way, is that the profit motive is not the only motive. That means if there weren't a profit motive, the person must at least feel, well, maybe I wouldn't do this kind of thing, but I would still do for other people. If a person says to himself, I would do no chesed if there was no profit in it, then it's not tzadik gomer, obviously. But we're not talking about such people. We're talking about people who would do chesed, and in a particular chesed, their basic motivation is profit. That doesn't matter. That's begeder kedusha. They're involved in kedusha much more than a person who might be involved in things spiritual all the day and only for himself. He has no intention of teaching others. He has no intention of helping others. He has no intention of doing chesed, no intention of doing tzedakah. All he's worried about is himself. Such a man is involved in less kedusha than the man who does nothing else, but all day is involved in working out how he can make a pound of butter cost a 0.5 cent less. That's kedusha. What's the problem with that kind of kedusha? The problem is that you're constantly gearing yourself to other people's needs. And as a result of that, you'll start changing your standards of behavior to suit other people's requirements and needs. The problem of too much chesed is, the Gemara says that arayas, sexual immorality, is just chesed taken to an extreme. It's just kindness taken too far. So there's a boundary. The problem with being totally involved for other people is communism. Lands up, but there's nothing else, just other people, and there's no value system to which you subscribe. But that's not so if there's genuineness, if there's preciousness. The one way that you can influence other people without compromise is through preciousness. The world responds to preciousness even if it doesn't like it. Somebody brings you a painting which is precious, even if you don't like the painting, you hang it up. Why? Not just for the cover. There's something there. The fact that a little piece of canvas can be worth 20,000 rand means that it's precious. If it's precious, it means something to you, even if you don't like it. If a person has the midah of segula, if a person has the midah of preciousness, he's able to be involved with people at one time, remaining authentic, uncompromisingly authentic, but at the same time attractive. How? Internalization. To go around uncompromisingly faithful to your principles, you're going to become dogmatic, inflexible, and generally a pain in the neck to everybody around you. Sticking your nose in, not being able to fit into anything, being a misfit in everything you do, in fact, and generally making other people feel uncomfortable and out of it. That's the one side of the coin. If you're going to be uncompromisingly faithful to the formal principles, there seems no hope. If you're going to try and be ma'urudhi ma'briyus, you're going to try and get on with people, surely that's going to involve you in compromising. No. If you're uncompromisingly faithful, but you're faithful to something which you've internalized, it's genuine, it's not something you've taken on, it's part of you, so much so that the other person can see that this, okay, he's uncompromising, but not to a dogma. He's uncompromising to his own beliefs and understandings that anybody respects. Nobody disrespects a person who's faithful to his own understandings. What people can't tolerate is when the person comes along and feigns a faithfulness to something he doesn't understand, doesn't know, and doesn't really care about, in essence. If there's shamil, if you've listened to Torah, and you've absorbed it, and it's part of you, and now your performance of the mitzvah, the shmiras habris, is something which comes out of you, not something which has been imposed. The initial shmir was an imposition. Somebody forced you to listen, and you heard, and you internalized. But now it grows out of you, as the Chovas Halvavas said this afternoon. It's got to be, there's got to be a desire to do it on the part of something internal. Otherwise the external mitzvah is meaningless. You've internalized it and now your heart wants to do it. And it's you who wants to do it. It's not somebody who's told you to do it. That you can walk around in the street with. There's no problem. And that's with, particularly with the external mitzvahs, and how much more so with chumras, with things that aren't mitzvahs at all. There's nothing wrong with a chumrah. A chumrah is a wonderful thing, as long as you haven't stolen it. A chumrah can't be something you've picked up from someone else. It's not a disease, sometimes it is a disease. It's not infectious. A chumrah has to be something which comes out of you. You feel on the level of Yirah Shamayim that the next step for you is A. That's fine. But to take a chumrah because you saw him doing the chumrah, that's something which is so despicable. And so laughable and comical because it's unbelievable. You walk around, it's the old example, it's the monkey wearing a suit of clothes. Suit of clothes looks well on him, why shouldn't it look good on him? It doesn't, because it suits him and it doesn't suit you. All for me to go and take somebody else's suit of clothes, and because it looks good on him, it's supposed to look good on me. No. Clothing and everything else, everything one does, has to be an externalization of something inside me. How does it come inside me? Shmir. I got it from somebody else. That's where we get one from another. We don't just imitate, we absorb from one another. One sits by one's Rebbe and one understands the yesodus of one's Rebbe's philosophy. One understands the principles in depth and one internalizes those principles. And then one uses those principles to develop one's own thoughts. That's shmir v'asiyah. That's learning and doing correctly. To give you a simple example, and we're just about finished. I could, instead of giving the shiurim such as I do on a Motzei Shabbos, I could simply take the shiurim of Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz on the Sedra, or the shiurim of the Tel Zerov on the Sedra, and I could learn those up, and I could give you those shiurim. They're better than these shiurim, believe you me. Much better. But you would fall asleep in the middle. Why? Because I can only get excited about something which fulfills two conditions. It has to be authentic, and it has to be genuine. It has to be original. It has to be precious. It has to be my own, otherwise I'm not excited about it. It has to be MS, otherwise I'm not excited about it. I, in fact, prepared another shiur this afternoon. A much more brilliant shiur, I think. And because of one word in a Targum Yonasan, I had to destroy it. There was one word in a Targum Yonasan which showed me, if I was absolutely honest, not emes. It's not authentic. It wasn't even a Targum Yonasan, it was a Targum Yerushalmi. And I could have frauded it, because I assure you that even if you would have revised the shiur, you wouldn't have found the Targum Yerushalmi. And even if you found the Targum Yerushalmi, you wouldn't have noticed that word, I assure you, nobody here would have noticed it. It's not emes. I lost my excitement and enthusiasm for it. It's original, but not authentic. A shiur has to be authentic, and it has to be original. Then it becomes precious.
When it's precious, I can transmit it. Once I'm excited about it, I can make you excited about it. So it's not as brilliant as the Telzer Rav Shir. So it's not as brilliant as Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz's Shir, but it's the best I can do. And that's why I don't like tape recorders going around to people who weren't present at the Shir. You must also know that the Shir is unique. If you think, if you're not at the Shir, you can hear it on a tape recorder tomorrow, it's no longer special, that's no good. You've got to know that whether good Shir or bad Shir, there's only one time in all your life that you will ever have the opportunity of hearing this Shir, and that's here. There's no other time you'll have it. You'll hear better Shirim, you'll hear worse Shirim, you'll hear different Shirim, you'll hear the same concepts in different presentations, but to hear this Shir, there's only one time. That's here. Because then it has that preciousness to it. The hour we spend together then is precious because it has a combination of authenticity and originality. It becomes precious. And with preciousness one can affect others. Reb Naftali Amsterdam, who was a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanta, they found among his notes once, his Talmidim found a little note, Ani mekabel al atzmi, I accept upon myself, lahachzir et kol am Yisrael lemutav, to make Baalei Tshuva of the whole people of Israel. Everybody should be good and right. I accept upon myself. So they asked him once, well, they found it. They told him we found it. How did you plan to do this? What was your master scheme? The whole of Am Yisrael. He said very simply, I planned to be a walking image of the Shulchan Aruch. Anybody would see me, they would know. That's Torah for me, without any doubt. That was my plan, that was my scheme. Preciousness is something which is infectious. Everybody wants something that's precious. It doesn't matter if they like it, if it is their taste, if it isn't their taste. Give your wife a diamond, she won't complain. Won't say she doesn't quite like the color, and she doesn't like the setting. She'll take it, and she'll enjoy it, and she'll have nachas from it. Preciousness is something anybody responds to, anybody loves. And preciousness is something which is the midah that is a precondition for Torah. Everything else comes from Torah, but the desire for preciousness is something Am Yisrael had to be mekabel on themselves before. And if you look now at the next sedra, you'll see at the next pasuk, "Va'atem tiyu li mamleches koyanim v'goy kodesh," and you shall be to me a mamleches koyanim. What does that mean? Says the Sipurnu. Lahavin ulahoyrois lachol hamin haenoshi, to understand and to teach to the entire human race. Right? That's what we are, we Jews. We're not just for ourselves. God charges us here with being a mamleches koyanim, a kingdom of priests, a kingdom of teachers. Says the Sipurnu, that means to teach the entire human race. Likroi kuloi b'shem Hashem, to call in the name of God, monotheism, and to serve him shoulder to shoulder as one race, to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the function of the Jewish people. Note, he says lahavin ulahoyres. Mamleches koyanim seems to mean a kingdom of teachers. He says no, to understand and to teach. Because if you haven't understood with bino, with internal understanding, bino is also a word used for internal knowledge. If you haven't understood with internal understanding, you can't teach. You can only teach something you're excited about, and you can only be excited if it's yours. Lahavin is the precondition. Ulahoyres, and to teach, kol min ha'enoshi, the entire human race. Monotheism. That's what we're here for. So we're here to affect people. We're not here to hide ourselves away. We're here to affect people. What about our Kedusha? To be at the same time a Goy Kodesh. To affect people in terms of being Kohanim. And that should be our Kedusha, that everything we're doing is in terms of others, is for the good of the Klal. And here we see the basis to human to progress in Torah. That's the next step one takes in Torah, and there's always a next step. It has to be followed always by Shmir. One has to understand it. You can take another step on. You can go one step higher. There is a concept of Na'aseh v'Nishma. You can go one step higher than where you are. But simultaneously there's got to be a Nishma. You've got to internalize that mitzvah. There's no point in taking on a mitzvah which you don't intend to internalize. And once you've taken it on, you are obliged to internalize it. And internalize it. And then when you do the mitzvah, it's got to be you doing the mitzvah, not because somebody else did. And then one can walk in the street, and one can defend one's Yiddishkeit. One can defend one's beliefs. One can in fact be aggressive with them. One can teach one's beliefs. one can teach one's Yiddishkeit to other Jews, to non-Jews. Not only that, chas v'sholom, we shouldn't be a laughing stock and therefore a chilul Hashem, but on the contrary, that we should be a kiddush Hashem, that we should be able to teach at kol min ha'enoshi, the whole human race. That obligation is on each one of us, not just the Jewish people. Mamleches Kohanim is not the same as Goy. Goy is the nation, will be Kedoshim. But Mamleches refers to each one, a king is an individual. We should be a nation where each one of us are kings who are Kohanim. That means each one of us take it upon ourselves to influence the entire human race, everywhere, to monotheism. How do we do it? With one simple middah, preciousness. That what we do is authentic. That we don't, in order to teach people, compromise our standards. But we're not dogmatic and out of touch. As well as being authentic, we're at the same time unique, special, original. We've internalized what we're teaching. We know it, we understand it, it's ours. Even if the Torah would be taken away from us, we would carry on doing it because it's ours. And then we have an Am Segula, we're a nation of precious people, precious to the Ribbono Shel Olam, precious to one another, and precious to the entire race of humanity.